Europe is complicated. Who agreed to any of this? Previously in Europe, technocrats.
And welcome to Previously in Europe. I am Kieran, and I am joined by my wonderful co-host, Hugh O'Brien, who's over there being beautiful.
Yes. Sure. Audio podcast.
Take our words for it. We're both very handsome. Anyway, time for some quick headlines before we get on to our topic for this evening. So, beginning in Italy, there's a lot of follow-up with the elections that happened. Remember those elections that happened that resulted in, like, the nightmare scenario?
That was months ago, Kieran. What are you talking about?
Yeah, so the recent Italian elections, for those who haven't been following along, resulted in the populist five-star movement being elected as the most seats for any single party, and then the right-wing coalition becoming the far-right coalition, because the largest party within that is the fascist League Party, run by Matteo Salvini, which was worrying. Anyway, this has resulted in like a massive impasse, because basically the only formable government is the five-star movement and the League getting into bed together, which has been opposed by the pre-made coalition that the League was with, like, namely Silvio Berlusconi. Anyway, this week has resulted in the president of Italy, Mattarella, being like, how about we form a neutral government if you can't make a coalition? He's specifically saying neutral government because what he's talking about actually is a technical, like, caretaker government, which the last time that happened in Italy resulted in scandal. So he's using the word neutral and not technical this time. Mattarella is tipped for favoring a senior kind of bureaucrat, civil servant called Elisabetta Belloni for prime minister. If she was chosen, she would be the first Italian female prime minister, which would be kind of cool, but that's definitely not the way you want to go about it.
Yep.
And yeah, Mattarella also gave a fairly scary speech today in Italy about how, kind of directed at like Europe as a whole, but basically talking about how Europe, Italy's problems are quite contagious, and this is due to the wind of war is blowing and Europe's edifice is shaking, is an exact quote there.
Dramatic language.
Very dramatic language. Very dramatic language indeed. He says the European project has lost its ability to meet the expectations of the large portions of the population. So, yeah, that was a... kind of, if I were to read into it, I was saying he's kind of like leaning towards Macron's suggested reforms. But yeah, that's not really going well. I'm sure we'll talk about that next week or the week after. Anyway, in the other parts of this, Berlusconi is no longer blocking the Nightmare Coalition from happening. I'm just letting my bias show by calling this the Nightmare Coalition. But yeah, I haven't heard of a better name.
I think that's bias. I think that's like a reasonable like reading of their combined manifestos. Because like, as in, the League has a lot of like... like it's a lot tempered from its Northern League days, where it was like Northern supremacy for Italy, whereas now like it had become a lot like a hard line version of Forza Italia in a lot of ways, and then Five Star Movement had like other crazy ideas, and they all agreed on like, you know, anti-migrant sentiment and stuff. So you're kind of like, what if you merged all of the worst parts of these two together? You'd get some terrible nightmare coalition, which might be what happens.
Yeah, that's true. It's the only electoral math that seems to work out that doesn't go into like a rainbow coalition that would probably wouldn't work. Anyway, Berlusconi was originally blocking Matteo Salvini's the League from actually forming this coalition, but now he's no longer doing that. So, hooray! In an odd turn, though, Berlusconi said that he and his party, Forza Italia, will not vote for it in the confidence vote if this coalition is formed, which is an odd position to take.
Yeah, but they'll not vote in the confidence vote, but they'll vote for, like, ongoing legislation that is in line with their platform. So
probably, which will be a lot of it.
Yeah. Moving to Czech Republic, everyone remembers the fun spying and subsequent attempted assassination of the Russian ex-spy in Britain. Well, there was conjecture at the time that they didn't have good proof that it was Russia, like, that did this, because Novichok type nerve agent that they confirmed was used for that attack was tested in some other places, including potentially the Czech Republic, and Miloš Zeman, everyone's favorite insane president of the Czech Republic, has come out saying that, yeah, it was manufactured in small amounts, tested, and we definitely destroyed it, though, last year in the Czech Republic. And Andrej Babiš, who I think was being, like, I feel like during the election, the Zeman and Babiš seemed to be, like, aligned on a lot of stuff. I think this is an example of, like, Babiš is actually just kind of like a potentially corrupt businessman whose politics you disagree with, whereas Zeman is like an insane person who happens to be president.
Yeah, so it's kind of retroactively becoming kind of funny, being like, everyone was worried about, like, Babiš. So Babiš is going to be like the Czech Republic's Trump kind of thing, like, oh, they're going to elect some sort of madman, and I was like, no, they already did that.
So Babiš was like the bad smell that has uncovered the, like, rotting corpse in the corner.
Zeman, the rotting corpse of the Czech Republic.
Yeah, so Babiš has called this a lie and is just like, no, that's not the case. But, like, this is in line with, like, the Russian media spin was just like, it could have come from a lot of places, even Sweden, Slovakia, Czech Republic, and it's like, oh no, Zeman, don't confirm this. Like, this is the thing that might be true, but, like, Babiš seems very, very anti that being a possibility, so I don't know, like, I don't want to live in a world where Zeman is like the voice of reason who's like, guys, it's so obvious, why haven't you seen this?
I was like, unless he has, like, his personal collection of this weird gas poison agent. It's like, I just, you know, I have that. I'm a collector. It's fun.
That just raises further questions.
The Bond villain of Central European presidents. Anyway, there were a lot of protests this week. Protests. Four protests. So Slovakia has ongoing protests. This is after the journalist was basically killed for trying to expose ties between the local government and Italian mafia.
Yep.
And this resulted, that happened like months ago, or a month ago, but the protests are ongoing. And while there's been some, like, reshuffling of Slovakian government to be like, oh, we're going to appease them, the protesters are still out in the street being like, nah, we want elections now. Yeah, so that's one of the protests. The other protests were Orban has his first day of parliament after the last election we talked about, and people protested that because it's Orban. And the seat of the Hungarian government is in Budapest, which is, like, the only place that didn't vote for Orban. So that's just inconvenient, awkward at best. Putin also had his first day of the new Russian presidency, and he had a ceremony in the Kremlin that was attended by about 5,000 guests, but there was about 1,600 protesters arrested outside from a very, very large protest. I'm assuming more than 1,600 protesters. Yeah, quite bad. And last protest before moving on to the next topic was there were protests against Macron in Paris and Toulouse. So, yeah, this is to do with his sweeping reforms, which we've talked about previously in this podcast, but they're not popular with a lot of people, and those people are the type of people who protest. So, yeah.
Speaking of people who are the type of people who protest, the Carles Puigdemont, who's still on the run, well, not on the run, he's in exile, he's in Germany, but he's awaiting extradition hearings, etc. The Catalan Parliament rejected the bid for him to become head of it, which is, you know, this is a lot of, like, this is kind of a, even if he could get back into the country, it wouldn't matter. So the Catalan Republican Left, one of the two main separatist parties that would make up the coalition that he'd be head of, rejected the bid to have him become leader. So that's great.
If I remember correctly, the Catalan Republican left did not like how right wing he was.
No, this is the thing. Is that, like, yeah, this is the problem with kind of one issue setups. And I mean, you get this in a lot of places where there's like a either vague or explicit independence movement is like, there people don't pay as close attention to the internal politics that they have otherwise, so that like it's hard to know in a independent Catalan how popular Puigdemont's party would be, how popular the left of the Republican movement would be, because kind of a large part of their focus is working towards independence, whereas, you know, local governments have a lot of actual things to do that people might be paying less attention to because they're like, I agree with their core principle. And you're like, wait, did you? Oh no.
Yeah, moving back over to what is definitely Europe, Armenia, just to follow up to the protests that have been happening there. The protests are over, like we covered last time, and the leader of that protest, or a MP of Armenian parliament who was heavily involved in the protests, Nikol Pashinyan, is now the prime minister of Armenia. Uh-huh. The ruling Republican Party kind of came around to his side and said, hey, you can be prime minister. This was his second attempt at becoming it. I believe last time we talked about this, we covered his first attempt, which didn't go down well. Kind of key criticisms comes from the fact that his reforms, quote-unquote reforms, are incredibly vague, and how this actually results in a material difference for Armenia is unclear.
Yes. Yeah. I don't know what the previous government was doing so wrong, but I'm against it. They were the government. There was problems, protested, not sure what the end goal was other than there needs to be reforms, and then at some point there will be elections when we change how the voting works. And it's like, well, that might be good or terrible. It's hard to know now. We'll see. We'll see.
Yeah.
Keep an eye on Armenia.
Nikol Pashinyan, you know, benevolent, only good politician in the room, or dictator for life of Armenia? Who knows?
Yes, time will tell. But you don't get a lot of ex-journalists that become strongman dictators, but maybe you should. Maybe you should. So moving to the UK, which I think we've been avoiding for quite a few weeks because it's just been the endless drudge of Brexit nonsense. But there was one piece of interesting Brexit nonsense that I wanted to mention, which, you know, has brought up an interesting topic for me, which is the House of Lords. So people who don't know, the UK's second house, the upper house of parliament, it is like an unelected kind of weird house where it's like mostly old, like previous MPs and then like business leaders and other people who have been appointed lords by like previous governments,
and Elton John
and Andrew Lloyd Webber, who really doesn't like poor people.
He keeps flying over from New York to specifically vote on things that disadvantage the poor.
Yeah, well, like if anything, you could argue he hasn't done that enough. Like he's not, because I think he's resigned now because of that problem. Anyway, basically, like any two-house government system, pieces of legislation go between the two houses, and the House of Lords lately, because it's packed with a lot of Labour lords from the many, many years of Labour governments, they have a lot of like voting power in the Lords, and they introduced a bill, an amendment to a piece of Brexit legislation that would require the House of Commons, the main house, to vote on whether or not they should be staying in the EEA, the European Economic Area, which is kind of like has been, you know, shot down by basically everyone who wants Brexit in the Conservative Party, the Conservative Party.
If this sounds unfamiliar to you, this has commonly been referred, especially in the British press, as the Norway model.
Yes.
Because the Norway's in the EEA.
Yeah, but not in the EU, and they basically like pay money to the EU to be in the EEA and have effectively market access. Yeah, so this has created a fun problem for the like a fun string and a number of problems for the government. But this does keep happening, where vague Brexit legislation will make it into the House of Lords. The House of Lords will add amendments to it to make it very specific about particular things they want, and then the government is like, "Well, that we didn't say that because we didn't want because half of our party hate it, so we didn't want to say anything about the EEA. Because if we do, there's going to be people who are like, you know, that's a good idea, and then people who are like, definitely not. So we didn't want to talk about it, but you've made us talk about it." And there was like an interesting opinion piece by a Labour MP, Jess Phillips, who was basically like, so like there's a lot of like reform minded people like on the more on the more left wing, especially, who were of the mindset of, you need to reform the House of Lords and basically get rid of it and replace it with an elected second chamber, or second chamber with like representatives from like bodies that aren't like the bishops and just former MPs and people who you know you can trust to show up and vote.
Like the Labour Party is the party in the UK that's most likely to have people who are Republicans in it, people who think the monarchy should be gotten away of. So if you think the monarchy should be gotten away of, you probably think the House of Lords should be gotten rid of too.
Yeah, and they did do, like, when they were in power, they did do a lot of House of Lords reform, which now effectively means it's mostly a place for old MPs. Is like they're now starting to make up like the a majority. However, like so Jess Phillips's point is like, well, now that the House of Lords is kind of, you know, giving more power to the Commons via its power, it's good and it's doing what I agree with. Like, it's preventing the government having a free-for-all on like vague Brexit negotiations, and you're like, oh no, this is a bad idea. This is how you get into the situation of, well, you know, now that the Lords are just there voting for what I agree with, maybe they're not so bad. It's like, no, you've twisted that into a way that's, oh no, I don't, yeah, I don't like it.
No, it's not good.
They need to, because it's in, like, you can argue like, oh, it's a good check on power, but it's only now that it's a good check on power because it's checking on the power you don't like, but it's very in line with stuff you want. So
we were having this conversation off mic, but it's very easy to say, oh, the House of Lords is a check on power. It's like, well, yes, theoretically, every second house is a check on power. Ireland also has a relatively unelected Senate. It's still a check on power. That's not the problem we have with it. The problem we don't elect the people who are a check on power.
Well, no, as we discussed previously, I elect the people we have check on power.
Ireland's system is weird.
Basically, it disenfranchises Ciarán and enfranchises me, the better podcast host.
I'm an uneducated swine who went to an IT.
Whereas I went to a university, so I have more voting power. Smart. It's a good system. It's a system.
Works 100%.
It's better than the House of Lords. That's all I can say about it.
Anyway, last little bit of the headlines. This week is Eurovision week, which is like sports but for Ciarán, and I'm excited. So I have like three small points other than the general like naffness that is the Eurovision, which is enjoyable for me to watch. I strongly recommend that you look up Belarus's live performance. There was all I will say is that there was a rose scar, which is grotesque and has to be beheld. Anyway, 3 points. Ireland has made it to the final for the first time in years, which a lot of people in our country are quite excited about. It's not a bad song. I hated the recording of it. The live performance was good. It's like a solo act from one of Louis Walsh's like forgotten boy bands that happened in the 2000s. Basically, not Westlife. Anyway, Cyprus and Israel are the current bookie faves to win. And yeah, I saw their performances. They're good. Israel would make for an awkward Eurovision next year.
The boycotts. There'd be so many boycotts.
So many boycotts, and especially if BB gets his way and we're like suddenly at war with Iran.
When BB gets his way and we're at war with Iran.
If it happens after the 2019 Eurovision, maybe it'll be fine.
Wait a minute. So now you might be expecting us to talk about like the Iran deal falling apart potentially, or some sort of peace in North Korea deal going on that like Europe might have something to do with. No. We're going to talk about something even more fun and sexy.
So sexy.
We're going to talk about the EU budget and how the EU budget works, because it's kind of confusing and garbage.
Hugh's had a long evening of looking into this.
I have, because so we were going to record earlier, and then Kieran was like, I have to watch the Eurovision semifinals. And 2 hours later, he came online. Anyway, so the reason I wanted to talk about this was because there was a lot of kind of coverage of the EU Commission last week put forward their proposal for how the EU budget should work. And when you hear budget, you immediately assume like, oh, annual budget. And then people would caveat it with, oh, we mean like it's the long-term budget for the EU. And that's kind of like the general way that people refer to this, but it's not technically what it is, because there is also like a yearly budget that is also referred to as the budget, the EU budget.
Yes.
Whereas the thing they're actually talking about is the multi-annual financial framework that will run from 2021 through 2027. So this is like the long-term planning that the yearly budgets need to fall under. I guess like the other thing that like the kind of headline grabbing aspect of the EU Commission's proposal was that they also proposed some form of system where budget payouts would be tied to, like, in the same way voting rights are tied to like the whole Article 7 prosecution against Poland, to potentially like reduce their EU voting rights, because if you're not like adhering to EU rules for membership, like in terms of an independent judiciary, which is what the problem they have with Poland at the moment, you can lose some voting rights. And the Commission wants to tie EU funds to this as well, because as it turns out, Poland is, in terms of percentages and also in terms of like total actual money, Poland is the biggest net gainer from the EU. They get back a significant amount more money than they put in at the moment, due to like there's a lot of like subsidies and stuff going to Poland, and like a lot of infrastructure projects being planned in Poland that are ongoing that require this to, this is the way it's ended up. I think it's kind of conspicuous that both the biggest net gainer from the EU is also the one that's been investigated for potentially having their voting rights restricted because of stuff the national government is doing. So I think that kind of muddied the waters as well, because it sounded like the EU Commission has put forward a budget that's going to happen quickly that also like impacts this Poland situation. Whereas I think, as we're going to discuss now, that's both unlikely and also simplifies how the budget works in a lot of ways, I think.
Right.
And yeah, it simplifies the, when we get into talking about Poland being the biggest net gainer, like a lot of what that actually means, and in terms of like percentages and stuff, like what that actually relates to, because Poland is, you need to remember, Poland's also quite a large country, so you know, you take that into account. So when you go, if you're running off like pure total net euro millions back out, so if you, so if you're going like off just total like euro millions back, Poland's percentage back is much smaller than Latvia's, Estonia's, it's smaller than Lithuania's, Hungary, like as in kind of, you're getting into those kind of percentages, and it's like as in kind of, once you start talking about things like that, it becomes more complicated. Anyway, so the EU budget. So like everything else in the EU, budget, it can, might mean two different things. It might mean the annual budget, which the Commission puts forward, and then the Council, so all of the national governments of the EU members have to unanimously approve it, as well as the Parliament. They also have to approve it. That happens every year, which seems arduous, but I think it's like it sounds to me like a good system, because like you do want all of those bodies to agree on something and like put it through, and putting the onus on the commission proposes it means that the national governments don't bicker endlessly over you've effectively like put forward like a group of people who you've said are competent for the jobs they're supposed to be doing, like they're effectively like they're technocrats running like a big advisory body that has to make everything they do public, which, you know, see, commission, I like the European Commission as an idea, and then putting forward a budget is good. But then this other thing that is actually more important and impacts what you can put in, what like the budget that the commission can put forward, is the multi-annual financial framework, which I've already said runs for 6 or 7 years. This also needs to go and be approved by all of the member states unanimously, and the parliament tends to have input, but like the main thing is the council representing all the EU governments needs to negotiate an actual budget and figures. And because there's like, as in, they don't make out a plan for everything that they're, every specific thing they're going to spend money on for the next 7 years. That's what's done yearly. The thing they're doing now is kind of more broad picture. So they kind of, they group up all the money into different sectors. So at the moment, the sectors include growth, which is like infrastructure projects and just general cohesion spending. That currently makes up the majority of the money. Natural resources, which includes the common agricultural policy. So all of the farm subsidies and stuff, the fishery subsidies. Yeah. A lot of environmental spending, that makes up another like 40%. So at this point, we're talking about like that's 90% of the budget is those two things. So that's most of it. Then the security and citizenship sector is like 1% of the budget, and then they spend around 5% of the budget on administration. So running the actual commission, which is a big, you know, public. Like a big employer of researchers,
assistants, translators,
exactly,
everything.
Making running the parliament itself, running all the EU buildings, running all the EU like missions abroad, the offices in all the countries. They say that makes up about 5% of the budget, and that basically makes up all of it. There's like some other like random special bits, but you know, that's effectively how that gets broken up, and then that's what you have to make your budget off. You have those percentages and kind of. There's some subcategories inside it as well that you need to spend money on. So like that's when people are talking about, oh, this time around the commission has put forward that there's going to be the common agricultural policy is getting smaller again, because there was a point in the pre 2014 multi-annual framework, the common agricultural policy was by far the biggest sector. It was 46% of the budget. Whereas the natural resources section, which is just like the agricultural policy is just part of that, was 42% in the last one. So you see like the EU is kind of whittling down what it thinks it should be spending its money on, like based on what it previously did. It's kind of getting rid of the things that people associate the EU with, which is like, you know, subsidies to make sure that everyone's dairy producers work correctly.
the common agricultural policy was also something that a lot of people pointed to as being like, it was unpopular for reasons that I'm not sure if I was ever on board with the arguments against it, but I'm not someone who had a lot of information on that, but I feel like diminishing the budget on that's like an easy win. Politically.
So it's kind of like, it was kind of unpopular like centrally in a lot of governments because it seemed like something that they wouldn't spend money on, which in a lot of ways is what the EU is for. Like that's why you have the commission put forward like an idealized budget of what they think is like a good idea based on like their research and not like political goals. In theory, that's not necessarily the way it actually works. Like the commission obviously has an agenda, but it was kind of mixed popularity depending on what country you were in and depending what like agricultural industries were important there before the common agricultural policy became a thing. And in a lot of places it was kind of seen as wasteful because it was often like production quotas that then wouldn't line up with demand very well. So it was kind of like a not necessarily the like a pinpoint accuracy good way of like pushing, like tipping the scales on different things that they think they thought should be produced. Whereas, you know, it's popular in areas where agriculture was becoming untenable, and the EU was providing a nice subsidy if they produced particular crops or dairy, etc.
Yeah.
So, like, one of the headlines was that they're going to spend more money on security, but like, security previously made up like a tiny proportion of the percentage. So it's kind of like that is notable, but it's interesting. So I guess getting down to like more interesting stuff, which is like, where does all this money come from? which, you know, is a valid question, because like, I think it's like the, I don't think I've ever met anyone who thinks there's like a specific tax they pay for the EU or something, but they're kind of like aware that their government put some money into it, and it's unclear how much money that is, because you start talking about such large numbers quite quickly. You're like, what, any number of that many zeros sounds like a lot of money. It's just, I don't know what it's relative to. It becomes very confusing. And like, as I was mentioning earlier, like the sizes of EU countries varies dramatically. So like, total like euro numbers isn't actually a useful way of looking at it. So the way it's calculated in theory is somewhere around 1% of the gross national income, which is calculated by gross domestic product plus money flowing in from foreign countries minus money flowing out to foreign countries. So basically it's like your trade deficit and your GDP combined to create like a common number to make it more accurate, to make it in theory accurate to what your like tax income should be roughly. So it's 1% of that is kind of the idea. This makes up like most of the money. That's about 70% of it. And then also every country pays in somewhere around 0.3% of their VAT receipts, so their tax on goods and services. Which again, that sounds very straightforward. That makes up basically all of the money. Other than that, there's like some custom duties that the EU charges for stuff coming from outside the EU, but like that makes up a lot less of the money. And then also the EU has money in banks that generate savings and stuff, but you know, that's again not the main money. Is money directly from the governments, which is how most people assume it works.
Yes.
But then it actually starts getting complicated, because once large sums of money start getting involved, national governments become snippy about how much money they think should be going into things. So like when the EU joined, there was an initial concern that when the UK joined, there was a concern that the UK had a lot more trade than most of the member states with non-European countries. So that it would work out that they would end up paying like a lot more total money. Like they made up a very large proportion of the total receipts if you worked off 1% of gross national income at the time. And then subsequently in the 80s, they negotiated for what is called the UK rebate, which still works today. The way it works is you calculate it like it's a complicated calculation. The simple version of it is that roughly like whatever the difference between what money got spent on the UK and what money the UK gave in based on the 1% ish of gross national income, the UK gets back somewhere around 2/3 of that, and then the other countries pay for the shortfall in the budget. So the way the EU budget works is kind of, it's like, it's sort of backwards. So basically the EU gets everyone to agree to the budget, then they spend all the money, and then all the states pay in. And this is part of the reason why this happens, because you need to know how much money the UK got back otherwise to know how much money they needed to pay.
Jesus.
You need to work that as a calculation. And then, because people didn't like this,
surprise, surprise.
Yeah, right. There are some exceptions to this rule. So Austria, Germany, the Netherlands, and Sweden, in the most recent, multi-annual framework, they get back, they only have to pay a quarter of what they would pay, for the difference. So like out of the hole that the UK has left by taking back their 2/3 of whatever they put in more than they got out, Austria, Germany, Netherlands, and Sweden don't have to pay for most of that, regardless of what percentage of it they should have to pay for. Should have is in quotation marks. Then on top of that, a further complication is Austria, Denmark, Netherlands, and Sweden all get back fixed lump sums of money. Just because they complained until they got it, I guess.
They really need money, those countries.
Yes, you know. Yeah.
The cash-strapped countries of the EU.
Yeah, so like this is the problem with these exceptions is like it is very much like the people in the strong negotiating positions were just like, everyone else has to pay more, we think it's unfair. And it's like, well, I mean, sure, but tenants of the EU, etc., the overall goal, okay, it's fine, you can have your lump sums, it's not that much money. So like Austria got back 60 million euros in total, which I think is like, that seems really petty to have argued for. I don't know.
Maybe at a, like at a state governmental level, yeah, probably.
Yeah, exactly. Also, there's one more exception. Germany, the Netherlands, and Sweden. You'll notice, the Netherlands has shown up in all of these exceptions.
Yeah.
Germany's shown up in two, and Sweden has shown up in two. So, you know, they're doing pretty good. I mean, like Austria and Denmark, they really need to get their shit together and complain more. So, I know Sweden's appeared in all of them as well. Germany, yeah. Get your shit together. So they also get, instead of paying the 0.3% of their VAT receipts in, they pay 0.15. I guess they were arguing that like their VAT was disproportionately too high, too much money. So I mean, like, I think, yeah, so this is complicated. Stupidly complicated. So Gunnar Oettinger, the commissioner for... in charge of having to deal with this nonsense.
He's basically his official title.
Yeah, commissioner for this shit. He's effectively said that, well, the UK is leaving, so obviously the UK rebate is going to stop becoming a thing. Can we just get rid of all of the exceptions? I think that won't happen.
No. No, it won't. Oettinger is not someone I usually agree with. In fact, he's done some really dodgy shit in the past. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I kind of agree with that.
Yeah, right. I think this is the thing in that, like, I think anytime this is what really annoys me about US politics in general, is that anytime anyone ever talks about like budget reforms or tax reforms, and you're like, I agree with that as an idea, and everything you said makes sense, but you're not going to do that.
Oh yeah, like, so yeah, the other criticism would be that you don't think Oettinger would actually follow through with that.
No, I think Oettinger has been genuine, that he's like, why is the budget calculation process complicated? It doesn't need to be. You could literally just have it as those two raw percentage numbers, and then whatever other money the EU is getting, like, from itself anyway, because like you know, on a like balance sheet wise, they end up with money like people they didn't have as much staff in the EU as they thought they would, so it's technically like extra money in their budget because they'd budgeted for it. So it's like, it's complicated, budgets are complicated because of those things, but why is it complicated as well to be like, well, the UK was getting snippy about how much money they paid, so instead of us changing the percentage for everybody, we gave this weird exception for them because they thought the way we calculated it was unfair, so we made it more complicated so they had exceptions. And you're like, once you start carving out loopholes, you start having to carve out more loopholes until, like, at some point in the future, someone's like, one of the countries who are now like arguably advantaged by the EU but disadvantaged by these weird budget loopholes are going to become like, they're going to end up with like their economy might boom, and that will cause problems for this calculation, because you'll be like, cool, well, now in the budget we need to add more loopholes for like this budget, like this sector doesn't count, or this industry doesn't count towards it, or the way you calculate gross national income is unfair for these reasons.
It all fell apart when like Poland became the leading country of like jetpacks, and we're like,
yeah,
god damn
well,
it.
This is the thing. I'm not like the. I think you don't. This is. It's the same problem as like. Like conversely, the Commission is proposing like tying money to. Rule of law requirements, and it's like,
yeah,
So you want to disadvantage like the citizen, the EU citizens in that country because of something their national government is currently doing, and not based on, and that also would make this a very complicated nonsense driven thing, because you would end up then in a situation where Poland would stop, like Poland in the example here, would just then they would just stop paying towards things, and that would start causing problems.
I mean, yeah, so this is the, if you thought your accounting experience was frustrating beforehand, wait until you include like morality judgments into it as well.
Yeah, and this is the thing, it's not interpretable, and their idea largely about it is, oh, we need to have like a peer review system for rule of law, and it's like, cool, that sentence doesn't really mean anything specific, and who is going to run this?
Oettinger again, he seems to be having a chill time.
Yeah, I think the main thing to consider with this is that it all matters in terms of scale quite quickly, like as in the scale of these things is quite confusing, because all of the countries differ wildly in size, and then their economy isn't proportional with the people in them. Sometimes it is, sometimes it's not, like there's exceptions, and then
so that's an interesting thing, that's like the divide of Europe, of the whole Eastern Bloc kind of thing, because Europe actually does work on most populated country is the richest country if you exclude the former Eastern Bloc countries. Because it's like Poland is the sixth largest EU country, but it is not the sixth richest.
No.
But before that, everything works. Like Germany is the richest country. It's also the largest. France is the second richest. It's the second largest. The UK is the third richest. It's the third largest.
Yeah, for sure. I think that stops tricking down when you look at like net contributions and stuff from the EU. As well.
And then you can also get into the whole like GDP per person, and it starts getting a little, it doesn't equate out, because you have things like Luxembourg where everyone's rich, I think.
Yeah. And they're net contributors to the EU. Yeah, because I think like I think it's very easy to kind of frame things as like, oh well, like Germany foots the bill for the EU is like a common thing that people in Germany complain about, and this was the big thing about Brexit, was like the UK pays a disproportionate amount in. It's like, well, like yes, the UK's money is around 10% of the total budget, but your actual, like, you get most of that back. You're negative percentage is 0.25 your gross national income coming out.
Yeah.
So actually, the EU makes up like a small but not insignificant portion of your budget, but like the deficit you have of the EU is very small, and is considerably less significant. And then once you start looking at the side benefits you're getting, you're like, well, actually total price of this is quite low, because you get this money back in ways that, like, realistically, yes, your government locally wouldn't spend it, but it's on bigger it's generally on bigger picture stuff, like the common agricultural policy. While we shit on it a bit, and like I think it's good that it's going away slowly, it's something you couldn't have tried with on a national scale realistically.
No.
Especially the fisheries policy, which I know is a separate thing, that actually is like, they're now discovering that with Brexit negotiations, that actually is like it was actually great that the EU was somewhat sorting out fishery rules, because agreeing like treaties with countries to agree on fishing rights and stuff just pisses off everyone's local populations on coasts.
Yes, it does, yeah. Oh, dear.
Yeah. How do you feel about the EU budget, Ciarán? Does it make sense to you?
It definitely makes more sense to me now. From a practical, I understand how it works. Why is not a great question. I feel generally uncomfortable by agreeing with Oettinger. about something. Although I'm looking forward to doing this podcast for a longer period of time and wondering if the complaints towards how the EU budget works is something that just comes up like every time it's brought up, like kind of reminds me of American citizens dealing with like tax season. Where like remainder of the year, you like remainder of time when it's not happening, you're just like, oh, this all works, it's fine, it's brilliant, everything's ticking along, and then you start having to look at it and you're just like, oh god, what is any of this? This doesn't make any sense.
Like a lot of it I understand the reasons behind it and like why you've made it complicated, because like, oh, you're making a budget for 7 years, so it needs to have like multiple levels of checks. But then it's like, in terms of like looking at it as like an event to be like, oh, like it'd be really good to discuss the EU budget on the podcast. Wait, no, nothing's actually happened with it. That's more like there'll be 2 years of discussions realistically before anything happens. At least another year. And realistically, the commission's proposal is probably quite far from like what you end up with. Poland might require that you have some sort of condition in the budget that like says in no way can you add rule of law as a requirement for this budget,
because we plan to do some shady shit.
Yeah, don't ask us why.
This is why, you know, like just the little side pocket of money set aside for weird novelty guns that Zeman can buy, all that good stuff.
We always talk about Zeman on this podcast. I don't know why. The Czech Republic is not that important.
He's an hilarious figure.
Yes, he is a hilarious figure. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the EU budget. Take it or whatever.
No, you kind of have to take it.
Yeah.
Previously in Europe is recorded and produced by Hugh O'Brien and Kieran Dold. If you like this episode, please tell a friend. That kind of stuff helps a lot. And if you've told all your friends or run out of friends to tell, which is the same thing really, you should leave a review on iTunes or whatever other podcast review service you use. That stuff helps us out quite a bit. If you want to keep in touch, we have a Facebook group. Just search Facebook for Previously in Europe and you'll find us. There we talk about things in the news, the podcast, and other fun stuff. As well, we have a Twitter account, at PREV in Europe, Prev in Europe. And we have a website, previouslyineurope.eu. There you can find links to everything important. And if something weird or interesting is happening in your country that you want us to know about and talk about, give us an email, previouslyineurope@gmail.com. We love hearing from you guys, especially if you're Bosnian. Please explain to me how your country works. I still don't understand it. Thanks for listening.